Okay, thank you very much for the invitation. We had a planning meeting on Sunday afternoon, and I was surprised to learn that the title of my presentation was going to change. Here's the original presentation, but the 512 code is currently under revision, is going to encompass biomass plantings, and we haven't been able to incorporate a lot of the literature about biomass, but to try and keep our literature synthesis contemporary with what that code is, I guess we've got some a little bit more writing to do. So our authors, Jennifer McAdam, Utah State, his speciality is on plant physiology, the establishment, seed physiology during establishment, and also the irrigated lands in the western part of the U.S. Twain Butler is based at the Nobel Foundation in Oklahoma, and he's our representative from some of the more southern pastures, certainly more familiar with warm season pastures than the rest of us. Mark Schultz is my colleague from Ohio State. Speciality is on alfalfa, maybe the more intensive pasture lands, the use of annual small grain annuals in cropping systems, and as well as alfalfa establishment. So just to kind of set the scene here, this is the Code 512 document. This is 2 pages, and so when NRCS field agents are looking to establish pasture, they will consult this guideline, and this has the specifications that they would use to plan and schedule and execute pasture and hay seedings. I think I just want to spend a little bit of time looking at this document. The key elements here are these purposes. And for pasture plantings, there are 7 purposes by which we might want to seed new pastures. And I'll expand on those in just a little bit. Look further down the document, the conditions where this practice might apply, and we got I'll expand on that in a little bit. And the key part of this document are these criteria. And these are the specific criteria that need to be taken into account whenever we're doing a seeding. And they're not enumerated specifically, but here one of the criteria is part plant species, and their cultivars shall be selected based on a whole bunch of different conditions. And the body of our document is dealing with these criteria, and we have broken them down into 11 key criteria. You'll notice here that this document that I've got here is specifically labeled Idaho. The 512 document I have here in my hand is September 2003, and I guess it's timely that this document is revised and there is a revision. Each state will have their own revision to this, and this is one for Idaho. Nothing can be removed, so each state, NRCS within each state, can't take anything out of the document, but certainly we can add details in here. And maybe I just go back. So we can see that the Idaho document has got 4 pages of specifications, whereas the national code has only got 2 pages. So they've added a lot more information in, and every state will have quite different specifications, but within the broad guidelines given within the national document. So the 7 purposes that we reviewed the literature, is to establish adapted or compatible species primarily for forage production. And I think most of us here will be sort of familiar with that reason, is that we would be planting forage because we want more forage production. A second purpose is that we might want to maintain livestock and or wildlife nutrition or health. So that we would be, a second purpose is that we might be planting forage for the purpose specifically to modify or improve the quality of the forage. Nothing to do with necessarily the production, but we're trying to improve the quality. A third purpose is to balance the forage supply. And although we may not affect the total production or we may not affect the overall quality, if we can change the pattern that forage might come, then that would be a legitimate objective. A really good example would be in the south that we might overseed annual ryegrass into Bermuda grass pastures so that we can improve the cool season production from that and get a more uniform forage supply pattern. So I think most of us are pretty familiar or comfortable with these three objectives or purposes, and then we get into the more environmental ones where we might want to reduce soil erosion, either wind or water. We might want to improve water quality for reducing sediment or nutrients, increase carbon sequestration, and here's the seventh that's been added as biomass for energy production. Wes has already talked about forages and their impact on erosion and nutrients in the runoff. So what we're addressing in our document is specifically, would the way we approach a seeding vary depend on whether we wanted forage production, whether we wanted forage quality, or whether we wanted to increase carbon sequestration? And I'm going to kind of jump to one of our main conclusions, is that by and large, when we're establishing pastures, we did not find a real overwhelming evidence that the way we would go about seeding for any one purpose would vary dramatically for any other purpose. Just touch real briefly here on the scope. We have a very wide range in the types of pastures that we would be seeding for. Grass and alfalfa for pasture land or hay land quite commonly. Grazed forest or agroforestry, so seedings into forests. Seedings specifically for cover crops only in the case that they are going to be consumed by livestock. So we exclude cover crops that are just there for organic mulch, but those cover crops that are going to be grazed, perennial seedings for wildlife, use of annual species within warm season pastures, as in the southern US. And outside the scope of our review are seeding grain crops where primarily their purpose is for grain production. And there's a large area of winter wheat that is grazed in the southwest, but the main purpose for that wheat is for the grain crop, not for the forage production. And so that purpose we've excluded from our review. And also any CRP land, because CRP land is not grazed for livestock. The primary purpose for CRP land is conservation of cropland, and that's already been addressed in the cropland document. So there's a lot of forage plants that are planted that we're not addressing. So I put this slide here. That's a description of our task, and the next couple of slides want to describe our approach. So we're reviewing the literature. Just want to take a little survey here. I did a survey in the CAB abstracts on forage or pasture establishment or seeding. Just take a guess how many references or literature that Cab Abstracts came up with. Anyone want to give me a, start me off with a suggestion? How much literature out there is on forage establishment?
439.
What's that?
439.
It's more than 439. Anybody want to have another guess? 5,000? It's more than 5,000. We got any advance on 5,000? 30,000 hits. There, this is, and so this is the worldwide literature. So it was kind of a daunting task to try to summarize 30,000 publications. Just to go to the other extreme, when you get a professor, we're going to have a pop quiz. So let's take a quiz. What would be a typical seeding rate for, say, orchard grass? Who could give me a seeding rate for orchard grass? 8 to 12 pounds per hectare.
Kilos
per hectare. So I searched in both Crop Science and Agronomy Journal for literature on the grass seeding rate to try and find papers about giving this recommendation to support a very commonly accepted practice. So how many papers would you find in Crop Science or Agronomy Journal that would give us information about a seeding rate for orchard grass? What's that?
Very few.
In fact, it's zero. I did not find a single paper in Crop Science or Agronomy Journal that would give us a recommended seed rate for tall fescue, for orchard grass, for perennial ryegrass, and for many of our common forage species. I was absolutely astounded, and so to try and we were charged with looking for the scientific literature, and something is one of our most common species in Ohio, and there's not a single reference in Agronomy Journal, kind of made our chore kind of tough. Nonetheless, we did cover 277 research papers. And we did spend quite a bit of time covering some herbicide labels that I'll explain as well. Just to cover a few definitions, mainly we had a definition here on what comprised the establishment period. There's huge variation, and some definitions of establishment would be until a seedling actually emerges. It might only be just one leaf. The legal definition of establishment with regard to those herbicide labels is when a grass has reached the five-leaf stage. And our opinion was that establishment was a period that lasted a little longer than that. We chose this definition specifically that the vegetation would reach full canopy cover and is available for any of the seven purposes for which it was intended. This is extremely, somewhat vague. Something like annual ryegrass might be established within 6 weeks, and then something like big blue stem might not be available for use for 2 years. So we're somewhere in the six-month to two-year period. The reason we had this definition is because it marked the boundaries of what we covered compared to what Lynn would cover under grazing, or Wes would cover under fertilizer management. Okay, so I'm sort of going to jump to the two. We were charged with the main findings. The literature is just horribly devoid of information on establishment failure. In fact, it's a little bit of sort of scientific philosophy here, is that the literature is extremely biased by research results that are successful, and we don't publish those that are failures. Classic example was this spring we planted alfalfa in April, which is the perfect time in Ohio. We went and planted that, did everything right, perfect seed bed, soil tested, got the seeding rate right, coated seed, And then it turned cold. We had about a week of 35 degree weather and 4 inches of rain. And not a single plant came up, all the seed rotted. And we're not going to publish that. Actually, that was Mark Schultz's study. He's not here. His students are presenting next door. And so then we had another study that was not so important to us, but it was about the 25th of May, and we're thinking this is kind of outside our planting window. We kind of had to get something, so we went and planted. The cool conditions kind of persisted, so instead of it getting hot and turning dry, which often happens around the beginning of June, we got a fantastic stand. But throughout the literature, we found no information on... we found lots of things that worked, but the literature has very, very poor information on what fails. And this is very difficult when we're giving guidelines and recommendations. We can tell them what they should do, but we can't give farmers any information on what's their chance of something going to fail. There's no literature about establishment failure. We found relatively little information on environmental impacts, specifically from our seedings. But we also debated, we know intuitively when we embark on a pasture seeding is that we're going to pay the price. We're not going to be getting any forage during that period that the soil is cultivated, that preparation period, and that early establishment period. And this is something that farmers will accept as a production loss. And in turn, in the anticipation of getting a forage response down somewhat down the road. And in the long term, the reason that we will have a new pasture seeding is because we're going to get more forage over a five-year period than if we hadn't done that. And so we can accept a negative impact in terms of production, a short-term negative impact, because of the long-term response. We have no clue, no literature on what are the acceptable negative impacts environmentally. How much soil do we lose during a pasture establishment? How much carbon dioxide do we produce during that establishment phase? And equally, what's the net footprint of that? Is that possible negative impact acceptable given the long-term benefits that we might gain from that? Very, very little. Two very significant areas that we have poor information on. Just a little bit more about our approach. None of the other authors have mentioned this, but this is a screen capture from a server. We have kept PDFs of all of our 277 references in a server on our department's website. This is password protected, so we hope we're not violating any kind of copyright rules. But we have PDFs. And so some of the literature is kind of hard to find, and we think that one of the valuable outputs from our efforts is that people that want to find out more about some of the literature that we did use don't have to struggle to go find that. We have got all of that literature readily available. I'm not quite sure in terms of the outputs, we have our written chapter. But I think there's some ongoing discussions to make some of this, have some other outputs from our literature search, and one of those is the actual literature itself. I've got it here divided up by our 11 different criteria. So we've got it aggregated by chapter as well as all of the literature in alphabetical order. This kind of helped us. We were working all over the US, and often a lot of the literature was in common, so we kind of use this as our central depository for papers and as an easy way for us to find those and make those accessible to ourselves. Another resource that we have that we've spent a tremendous amount of time on is building this these Excel files, and each line in this Excel file is the citation. In this case, we're focused on the species that are in there, the purpose that that's going to be used for, something about the geographical location, and some other notes about that. So that we have this as a searchable database, we can scan this, we can find all of the, say, all of the species or all of the common names, all of the varieties. We're not going to have, these are not going to be in our written document, but these Excel files are going to be accessible on the online version of this. So just allude to that as part of our approach as well. Okay, the key criteria, we have 11 of those, and I'm just, for the rest of us, I've just got one slide on each that kind of summarizes the main findings in each of these areas on species, the establishment method, the sowing rate, planting depth, fertilizer and lime specifically as it affects establishment, planting date, rhizobia, seed coatings, pre-treatments, seed quality, post-emergence management, that's the first grazing, and weed control post-emergence. In yellow, the format I've got here is this is what the 512 document tells us. Whoa, what happened here? Excuse me. Plant or species shall be selected based on climate patterns, temperature extremes in the USDA plant hardiness zone, soil conditions, pH, water, aspect, fertility, levels of toxic elements, resistance to insects and disease. How can we dispute that? In total, we reviewed 60 different species. That's 277 papers, covered 60 species, 25 legumes, 18 C3 grasses, 15 warm seasons, and a couple of forbs. The literature, both the literature and the 512 guideline is deficient in any criteria for use of mixtures. Most of their recommendations and most of the literature is based on monocultures or relatively simple mixtures, one or two species, and I think there is good ecological basis for using more complex mixtures. What criteria should we use in establishing mixtures is really quite a shortfall both in the guidelines and the literature. And as much as I hate to say it, the literature is extremely deficient on how sowing rate might vary and how might this affect our long-term pasture composition. Even something as simple as a ryegrass white clover mixture, should we be using what might be the impact of 1 pound, 5 pounds, or 10 pounds per acre of white clover on the resultant pasture mixture? Is that we just really have very little idea, and where we commonly might use 3 pounds per acre is really just a kind of an accepted practice. And if we wanted to change our final white clover composition, if we could achieve that with a different sowing rate, the literature really is very sparse in being able to tell us that information. We have got quite good information of species effects on production, species effects on pasture quality, and species effects on affecting the balance of the composition in terms of the annual production, but we don't have very much information on wildlife, species effects on erosion. Would we get better erosion control with perennial ryegrass or tall fescue or reed canary grass We don't have good information about that. What is the species effects on the water loss from those? Very little information in those areas. Establishment method. Mark Schultz did a very comprehensive review on basically comparing full cultivation with no-till. Just to run through what the guidelines tell us, specified methods shall be consistent with documented guidelines cited by plant materials programs, research institutions or agencies, demonstration trials for achieving satisfactory establishment. We can't dispute that. The method, when you an NRCS field officer wants to embark on a planning program, they should take the best local advice. Can't dispute that. There is another proviso where air quality concerns exist. Site preparation should be utilized that minimize airborne particulate matter generation and transport. There's no literature about that. We couldn't find any literature about airborne particulates for one establishment method over another. Mark Schultz found 25 papers that compared full cultivation with no-till seeding that affected both the production and the quality of the vegetation. He found 4 papers that compared full cultivation with no-till on soil erosion, but no data on any of the other 3 or 4 purposes. Little information on sprig seeding, benefits of no-till systems for erosion, and inconsistent benefits from companion crops. Running out of time here. I'll skip through. For sowing rate, we have 29 papers. I'll skip through real quick here. Planting depth, we had 24 papers for legumes, 25 papers for grasses on planting depth. Many of these purposes, there was no basis for differences in planting depth between those purposes. What we would recommend for one purpose would be adequate for another purpose. Fertilizer and lime, 5 or 6 papers there looking at some benefits for nitrogen, no benefits for potassium. Seeding date, 28 papers. This guideline here focuses on soil moisture, but totally understates the importance of temperature, and this guideline should be revised. Rhizobia, 30, Twain did a tremendous job looking 33 papers on effectiveness, 21 papers on the different strains, and 16 papers on different methods to optimize nodulation. Seed coatings and pretreatments. The guideline here says using coated seed, recalibrate to deliver the same number of seed, that's pounds of live seed, as would be applied with non-coated seed. We found no evidence in the literature that supported this. Where we have benefits from using coated seed, such as enhanced establishment, and we did find in many cases about that, would justify use of a lower PLS rate when we had coated seed. And in many cases, we found faster emergence, more seedlings, but we found very little evidence of responses of yield at 1 year with coated seed. Seed quality, 9 papers. Post-emergence management, 3 papers. Weed control, 47 papers, and 32 product labels. Summary of our knowledge gaps. We have a deficit of knowledge on the stand failure, the risks with establishment. We have very little environmental information of grass-to-grass seedings. We might extrapolate some environmental impact from cropping systems if we were going from a cultivated soil to a grass seeding, but where we have high organic matter soils, as occurs within grass to grass, we have very little information of CO2 loss, water impacts, or erosion. Very little information on biomass, although this is changing very rapidly. I did a calculation, if you bear back, that we had 30,000 potential papers. If we were to look at if we had 60 potential species that we found, 5 cultivars, 50 possible environments that maybe represent states, different soil types, seeding dates, climatic zones, the 11 key criteria which would might encompass sowing depth, sowing date, sowing rate, species choice, our 7 different purposes and 15 different livestock groups if we were looking at sheep, cattle, horses, birds, impact on spiders, the soil biota. If we were to multiply that up, the amount of we would need 17.3 million papers to cover all the information that we need. Many, many cases, we're just taking a guess on some of the guidelines. There's a huge deficit in terms of the information that we need to know. Identify some emerging issues real quick. Roundup ready perennials, especially alfalfa, but maybe some of the grasses are going to have a huge impact on how we establish pastures. Continually we have new varieties and cultivars. There's some interesting developments in seed coats with water absorbent seed coats and plastic films that are going to affect our flow of our seed with seed coats that may have some difference. Novel non-toxic endophyte options are going to affect our species choice. Genetically modified technologies as they come on stream. Climate change, variable rainfall, warming temperatures and differences in CO2 are going to affect our establishment practices. Biomass, we can talk about that more. But also specified production systems. If we were to look at the constraints of an organic establishment compared to a conventional or establishment, a lot of differences about how we might establish organic seeding compared to conventional seeding. Whether we have natural or grass-fed livestock products are also going to have impacts on how we go about our seedings. Just a few issues. Okay, thank you. All right.